Welcome, everyone. I'd like to convene today's House Revenue Committee. Our good chair is in a meeting. I expect him back probably by 1:30. In the meantime, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Mazin?
21. What's that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 21 comes to you, of course, from your counterpart on the Senate side, through the Revenue Committee there. And Senate Bill 21 basically relaxes restrictions that work on the investment of some of the funds and certain Oregon funds, and allows those investments to be done in foreign securities. These securities are dollar denominated, of course, and supposedly a lot more secure than when the time of this prohibition was in place. The bill basically does relax that prohibition in two places, with the funds that in the short-term fund and in the local government investment pool. And I've put in your background SMS an idea of what these funds are defined in statutes. However, with all of that, of course, there is no revenue impact or a fiscal impact for the bill.
Questions of Mazin? Today's Treasury Day, so we're going to ask Michael Mueller to come forward on this, and we probably will be here for... Yes, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question, Ms. Mazin.
So what we're saying here is this bill would allow the various entities that invest in the state government to invest in foreign-held corporations, right?
Well, this, this would be the treasurer, the state treasurer, right? So they would be able to do that, right?
Okay. Great. Yeah.
Vice Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments for the Oregon State Treasury. Let's talk briefly about the Oregon Short-Term Fund. It's a fund that's comprised of state and local government operating cash that is invested for the most part in short-term investments so that the investments can be easily liquidated when money is needed to pay operating expenses. Think of it as the state agency checking account or the local government checking account. Under current law, neither state funds nor municipal funds in the Oregon Short-Term Fund can be invested in any securities originating outside of the United States. What we'd like to do is remove this prohibition to enable the fund to invest when the opportunity is appropriate, and also in terms of diversifying the portfolio in securities that originate outside the United States but that are dollar denominated. It is important to note that the investments anticipated by removing this restriction would not incur foreign currency risk. And we're also not talking about international equity or emerging market equity. These are fixed income, short-term instruments that happen to originate outside the United States. Additionally, as currently provided in law, the Oregon Short-Term Fund will remain under the authority of the Oregon Investment Council, with advice provided by the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board. The rules for the Oregon Short-Term Fund are approved and authorized by the Oregon Investment Council, and they're available for public viewing at all times. They're presently on our website. And the goals of the Short-Term Fund will not change. They will be in order: the preservation of principal, number two, liquidity, and number three, yield. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have about this change.
Questions for Mr. Mueller? Yes, Representative Volkers.
Madam Chair, would you go into some of you've listed some samples at the bottom of your testimony, and obviously these are not necessarily, they have American assets, but maybe foreign held. So could you kind of explain what are the missed opportunities, the types of companies or investment funds you're talking about specifically by country or region?
Vice Chair Berger, Representative Boquist, the examples that are provided here are merely that, examples. The manager of the short-term fund, we have a professional staff. I would hesitate to go into the details of particular securities that he may wish to include in the portfolio. Certainly we are all held to the prudent investor standard, and it would be securities that he deemed appropriate within the law and within the investment guidelines.
Well, let me speak, Madam Chair. I guess my immediate concern is how would any dispute resolution be handled in regard to a problem with an investment? If it was a foreign national entity held, for example, in the United Kingdom, would you anticipate, I mean, working under British laws, international laws, I mean, you hypothetically could have a case of Enron in a foreign country in stock and securities that you own. And so I'm kind of looking at the thought process you came about and where you went with in determining we missed opportunity. Because I would agree there is opportunity overseas. But you need to be more specific, I guess, than hesitant.
Mr. Mayor.
Vice Chair Berger, Representative Boquist. The securities that are contemplated would be the most highly rated securities of these foreign nationals, so the risk of loss would be mitigated presumably by the ratings of these securities, and so that would be the highest level of assurance I could give you that we would envision using these securities within the portfolio. Certainly we deal with risk on a day-to-day basis within these portfolios with domestic companies as well, and I don't see it as being any different. The securities trade in the United States.
Ms. Representative Haas.
Thanks. There were some, I'm not sure how it all worked out, but I remember years ago, like in the 80s, there was a big fight about investing state money in South Africa, apartheid. What was the fallout of that and the restrictions placed in the laws? Are you talking about different securities prohibitions than those that were changed then?
Vice Chair Berger, Representative Haas, indeed we are. That was relative to the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund, that prohibition, and related to equity securities that had an interest in South African companies. The magnitude of that divestiture, I don't have the specific numbers, nor do I know the impact on the portfolio of that divestiture.
Well, if I could,
please.
Can you tell me why this was put into law to begin with, this prohibition? You got this,
Vice Chair Berger, Representative Haas. I don't know the particulars. It would be my opinion that it was put into place at a time when the security markets weren't as robust as they are currently, and perhaps there was some concern about securities not being dollar-denominated and therefore exposing the short-term fund, in this case, to currency exposure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess what you're saying, and part of the answer Representative Haas here, is that these would be dollar-denominated investments.
That's correct.
Yes, that was. Nazan, do you have any further information with regards to how long this has been in statute and its, I mean, the prohibition on these foreign-based securities?
Madam Chair, I think that goes, I don't have exact date, I think it goes for, is a long time a good answer?
Forever?
It has, I don't have a date here, but
we can come back and get further clarification of these issues. Representative.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. I'm looking at the bill itself, What you're telling me is the intent would be not to invest in anything except dollar investments, but it doesn't say that in the bill. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Berger and Representative Riley, that is correct. We don't prescribe in statute a lot of the things that are contained within the investment guidelines for the short-term fund. I brought a copy of the portfolio rules. Certainly we wouldn't want to codify all of these, I don't believe, in statute. But certainly when we take this up with the Oregon Investment Council with the consent of the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board, I believe we would have language in there that would restrict it to dollar-denominated securities. And if I might back up to your previous question.
Thank you, Kate.
ORS 294.835, if you look at Section 2, Sub 3, says, notwithstanding subsection 1 of this section, no monies in the investment pool shall be invested after June 30th, 1979, in any securities originating outside the United States.
1979. That's fine. So that does speak to when this was enacted.
Madam Chair, these now are all securities that are on American exchanges. All what they are originating, the parent company is a foreign company. Isn't that the case mostly for
this? That's correct.
So you're not going, they're not going outside.
These are on American exchanges.
Right.
Hey, anybody want further clarification on anything? Any further questions of Mr. Mueller on this? Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 21. The public hearing on Senate Bill 21, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 22. And let's go to the next one. See if it's easier.
Well, Madam Chair, it's similar in nature to the first bill. Senate Bill 22 removes a similar prohibition on the treasurer and investing in what's called common stock, and also allows the local government to take a direct position in equity. However, it also allows the treasurer to go through the investment without necessarily having to go through an intermediary, if you will. And in that sense, it allows them to build some sort of management process within the ranks of the treasurer. So it has that added provision into the bill, in addition to allowing them to go into the common stock. This also does not have a revenue impact in that sense or a fiscal. Of course, Madam Chair, I might add, this is all guided by the council, the Oregon Investment Council, which consists of the five members, and the state treasurer basically works as the investment officer of the council. So that's where the relationship here works between the investment council and the advice of the treasurer and that investment.
Okay. Questions of Mazin? Mr. Mueller, would you like to speak to this one?
Sure. Vice Chair Berger, members of the committee, again for the record, Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments for the Oregon State Treasury. I believe that the change contemplated in this law doesn't extend to local governments, but rather the Public Employees Retirement Fund and the State Accident Insurance Fund, which are presently listed under Section 1 of ORS 293.736, Paragraph 2. And what we're asking is to repeal the language that prohibits the investment officer from investing Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund assets or State Accident Insurance Fund assets directly in common stocks. As an independent consultant's review of large pension funds around the country indicates, it is a common practice for our peers to have in-house management, as it's termed, of equity securities. Currently in Oregon, we're not allowed to do that, so we hire third parties to do that on behalf of the funds. And in this case, it's the Public Employer Retirement Fund and the State Accident Insurance Fund. Earlier this year, we conducted a survey of large public pension funds. 20 of them responded, and I'd like to share some of those results with you just to give you a flavor of what some of these other funds in the country are doing. 18 of those 20 allowed direct ownership of equities. 18 are peer investment boards or are combined with the PERS administration. Of the 18 that are allowed internal equity management, 10 actually do so. And the average percentage of internal management is 62% with a range of 10 to 100%. The types of portfolios that they run varied from passive index funds to enhanced index funds to what we call fully active portfolios. All 10 are satisfied with the performance of their internal operations. Additionally, this removing this restriction would allow us to invest more directly in private equity and real estate assets in what's called co-investment strategies, which I'll explain a little bit further a little bit later on. Regarding that, 4 of the 5 funds do have what's called co-investment portfolios, and 4 of the 5 are satisfied with that performance. Only one fund has statutory limits on the amount that can be invested internally. And I'd be happy to share with you the complete results of that survey if you'd like to see that. Allowing Treasury to purchase and sell equities directly would result in 2 important advantages. One, it would likely save money in terms of investment management fees. And number 2, and this is in regards to the private equity and real estate portfolios, it would allow the state to leverage our established investment relationships, again, at a reduced cost. Internally managing investments in equities is extremely cost-effective, and using co-investments in private equity as an example, the current statutory restriction creates the need for the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund to hire outside managers to handle such investments. Currently, OPERF pays tens of millions of dollars in fees to underlying general partners on a $500 million co-investment vehicle that's presently in the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund. Managing these investments internally would cost a fraction of the fees charged by these outside managers. Not only can savings be achieved by managing private equity investments internally, they can also be achieved by managing some public equity investments internally. And using the simplest example of running a passive index fund, simply holding the market, say the S&P 500, if we were allowed to run that internally at the Treasury, we believe that we could achieve some cost savings over having to hire a third party to do that presently. Treasury is not seeking to wholly replace external management of funds with internal management, but rather we're seeking sort of another tool in our toolbox, if you will, that would enable us to take a look at the cost effectiveness as well as the strategies that we might implement internally by having such a program in place at Treasury. Before embarking on such an engagement, certainly it would be at the with the direction of the Oregon Investment Council. We're not saying that this program, if given the opportunity, that we would implement it, but certainly it would avail us of an opportunity out there that our peers are taking advantage of in terms of costs and performance that they're satisfied with. The current restriction also makes it difficult for Treasury to make co-investments in either real estate or private equity portfolios. Again, co-investments, or I should say to begin with, co-investments are private equity deals that are done by a third party, in this case general partners, on behalf of the pension fund, and oftentimes they require additional capital, and these general partners will come back to the limited partners within those portfolios to see if they have an interest in investing alongside the general partner in a more direct relationship. Because of the equity prohibition currently in statutes, Treasury and the Oregon Investment Council has to hire a third-party entity to conduct direct co-investments. And as you might imagine, these are costly undertakings. We believe that there would be the opportunity to literally save millions of dollars in terms of management fees if we are allowed to do co-investment opportunities in-house in the Treasury. So with that, I'll just open it up to questions, since I'm sure you may have some, instead of continuing with what I think you might want to hear.
Questions, Representative Bofill?
Yeah, Madam Chair. And this is a two-pronged question, I guess, for Moz and then for the State Treasurer's Office. The summary, the staff summary says that there's no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact. And the testimony we just received uses as one example the potential of savings of tens of millions of dollars in fees paid to an underlying partner on a $500 million co-investment. Now, obviously there's somebody's managing this fund, so on and so forth like that, which is why they're getting paid the tens of millions of dollars. Yet there's no fiscal and no revenue. So if the state treasurer took over, are you going to do this with existing staff and there is going to be no fiscal, or you have to hire additional people to do something like this? I guess what I'm saying, and you're from the state treasurer, is 2 + 2 isn't equaling 4 here.
Vice Chair Berger, Representative Boquist, in the event that this strategy would be implemented, certainly it would entail the addition of staff to the treasurer's office to invest in this manner. I believe that's appropriate and the prudent thing to do. We don't presently have the staff to do this kind of investing.
To follow up, Madam Chair?
By all means.
So you're saying there is a fiscal if you implement it?
That's correct.
Madam Chair, I guess, Lazen, have we requested a fiscal on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, yes, we have. The way, well, all the millions of dollars that will be paid, I have to say, that will be dedicated to Legislative Revenue Office from this point on.
I might concur with that.
For our expansion of service. I think the fiscal, this is an enabling legislation, as it says. So it allows state treasurer to do so. However, once they practice that option, it is not automatic that all the appropriation that needs to be given to them in order for the process to work, that comes with a bill. That will be a whole different issue. This in essence, enables them to remove that restriction and allow for the program to be adopted if chosen to be.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
By all means.
I'll let you bail out there in a minute. My question here, Mazen, is what I hear you saying is this would allow them to do it, and if I'm not mistaken, and I don't know enough about the State Treasurer's Office, and they'll chime in after this, but it would seem that there are obviously fees paid, so on and so forth. Does this bill not give them the authority to proceed regardless of fiscal if they can pay for it internally or out of the existing management fees they're paying?
Madam Chair, I don't think so. What new positions or new staff that needs to come through an agency would all go through the appropriation process. That's why just that bill by itself does not offer any additional fiscal expenditures in that sense. So when the fiscal office, I believe, and we could make more certain of how the fiscal office looks at it, when the fiscal office looks at the expenditure horizon of this, it says, do new expenditures required under this bill? And if that is so, how much and what is the impact for the agency would be? And under the bill as it is structured, there is no such thing at this point.
Okay. Follow up.
Yes. Okay. Go
yes,
ahead.
Madam Chair.
One more question.
No, I'm not. It's just a follow up. Well, I guess to the treasury and office. I mean, you can see my concern. This appears to be a good idea. And if it's a good idea, then you're going to implement it. Because you didn't bring it here just because you didn't have anything else to do. I mean, we got 6 or 7 people here sitting in the room. So therefore, I mean, let's hear more intent and what are we trying to achieve here?
Please.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Vocus, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff, Oregon State Treasury. Mazin is correct. This is enabling legislation, and this can be put in at a very, very small scale or at a larger scale. At this time, we are not expanding our staff. We are not looking to implement this in a grand scale. In fact, there are co-investments, even a single co-investment that this would allow us to pursue without any additional impact, fiscal impact to the state treasury right now. But in order to move that direction, you have to lead with the law, and that's the primary reason this is here before you today.
So I guess what you're trying to say is you're contemplating doing this. You have some opportunity in a small scale in front of you that you want to, for better, to do a pilot project on. Is that what we're saying? And then kind of proceed forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I think that's a fair assessment. What we'd like to do is avail ourselves of the opportunity to take a look at this more closely to see if in the long run, for example, if you set aside co-investment but say in-house passive equity management, if indeed it does pencil, the kind of staff that we'd have to bring in, the systems we'd have to bring in versus the management fees that we're currently paying, it may very well turn out that we can't do it as cost-effectively in-house for that particular sleeve, in which case we'll continue to manage it externally. However, I'm almost certain that the co-investment piece will pencil and we will have opportunities there to save money.
Okay, so if it, excuse me while I, if it does pencil, then what is the procedure? Then is this under the authority of the Oregon Investment Council to do this? And what safeguards do we have sitting here that that a good decision is being made? Do you understand? We're sort of releasing and not quite understanding the sideboards that exist already.
Vice Chair Berger, I think you'd have the same level of comfort that you presently have with all the investments of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, and for that matter, all the investments that are under the purview of the Oregon Investment Council, and we're all still guided by the prudent investor standard in ORS 293-726. Nothing would change under that. And if it were deemed prudent to have additional staff to implement these programs, I'm sure the treasurer would be back before you to ask for those positions if they were necessary, and we would justify them on a cost basis.
Further questions, Representative?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just for the record, to point out, I mean, obviously, another representative pointed this out. You know, we, in another committee, yesterday I was on the floor defending this, we provided simple enabling language with a simple intent, and it mushroomed to about 40 times larger than what we kind of envisioned at that particular point in time. And so I have concerns about just having enabling language.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Madam Chair, the expenditures in any way or the additional staff still has to go through the appropriation process of the legislature. So it still is a ways and means process. So that they won't be adding staff or adding expenditures to the agency without the added step of asking for the appropriations.
I understand. Yes, President Thompson.
Yes, the question I have is, does the Treasury Department already have the expertise within your staff? I don't know what the definition is of the investment officer, but in schools, the superintendent has to have the expertise before and the credentials to have to be a superintendent. Do you have people already in-house that have that level of expertise?
Madam Officer, Representative Kump, yes. And we do have in-house investment officers right now, but because of the scale we work with, we and other reasons, we do use external managers. But this is to take a look at bringing some of that in-house. We already do some in different capacity, but yes, we do have some of the skill here. I think what Mr. Mueller was discussing, too, is if there was an expansion of that or we need to realign our skills,
right.
Then yes.
Madam Chair, I just have a question on testimony. Do we have local governments, cities or counties that are signed up to testify on
We do not. It was my understanding from the testimony that Mr. Mueller stated that what is contemplated in this bill is not exactly local government taking direct ownership. Would you repeat, Mr. Mueller, your statement on that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. If you look at the bill itself, the clause that we're asking to have removed is Section 1, Paragraph 2, which states that the investment officer may not perform the functions specified in Subsection 1, which describes the prudent investor standards and that we may acquire, reinvest, et cetera, all the securities in the respective portfolios. But it says, with respect to the common stocks in the Public Employees Retirement Fund or the Industrial Accident Fund, that we're not allowed to do that. So I believe it only relates to those two funds.
Mazin, you want to speak to that?
Madam Chair, is by the reference to the ORS, that ORS within that definition is where the the investment pool, the local investment pool, is also included. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I mean, staff summary says, and I quote, allows state and local governments to take direct ownership positions in equities without contracting through outside fund management companies. End quote. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Local. That's as local as you get, Madam Chair.
That is. Mazin, is that what this bill?
Madam Chair, the. It is connected with the state treasurer type of investment, and the state treasurer does invest for the local pool, the local government investment pool, what do we call it, the short-term local government investment pool. And I think in that sense, also that investment pool is under those restrictions. Once those restrictions are relaxed, I think the state treasurer would have the ability to invest in that. That's what I was reading the statutes to do, whether it was an extension of reading of the statute. But the
Madam Chair.
Just a moment. Okay. Kate, you want to speak to this, and then we're going to... We need more work on this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is... This section, as Mr. Mueller pointed out, is a restriction only on OPER fund, the PERS fund, and on...
OPER, again, is...
Public Employees Retirement.
Okay.
And the Industrial Accident Fund, and that's... You'll find that on lines 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, so am I hearing that the staff, there's an error in the staff summary, or I'm only slightly lost here?
I think that there is some fuzzy area here, and I think that we need further work to get it clarified. Representative, so let's ask our questions that we can come back to when we come back again.
Good, Madam Chair. I'll pull up.
Thank you.
At some point, I'd like to know about the discussion on the Senate side, because I have the same concerns about checks and balances who are obviously discussed during the Senate hearings, and it's noted in the Senate staff summary, you know, outside influences. There's also this discussion involving the size of the holdings versus politically correctness versus public pressure. There was discussion in voting rights and investments in Oregon companies, and I think, I guess the first thing that historically jumps to my mind is the same thing Representative Haas brought earlier, and that is some years ago the whole issue of don't invest in South Africa here or there or so on and so forth. And so,
you would like to hear more of the testimony. I understand. Representative Polizio, you had a question?
Well, I guess more of an observation. I mean, it doesn't sound to me like, from what I read, that we're going to allow the city council of Scappoose to invest in derivatives or something. I mean, I'm a little surprised that these obstacles and barriers are in place. I mean, the last bill was kind of shocking to me. And this one, there is a structure in place. You have the Investment Council, and they have arguably conservative standards that they have to sort of follow. And I guess I'm just surprised at the degree of some of the issues that are being brought up, as if I don't know. I guess I just don't really understand.
I think
it's a lot of money, yes, but there's a structure that already exists.
I think that members of the committee, there's a lot of us who have not have a lot of great familiarity with the investment system of the state. I think that this committee is going to need a little more information on that before we proceed to work session on this bill and the one before, and perhaps others in this list. We haven't gone through them yet, but I think it's pretty clear we need a little better sense.
Investment 101.
In state treasury investment 101, if you don't mind.
Very well.
Okay. Is that
sure.
and rather than just a review of some of the Senate testimony, perhaps a repeat of some of the testimony.
We can do investment 101.
Is that a fair assessment, members of the committee? Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 22, and we're going to move to Senate Bill 20. Senate Bill
23A.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, if we had
if we're having any more fun, Madam. Another easy bill, Madam.
Yes.
Just a skinny little thing.
Skinny little thing.
How many pages?
And for the record, Madam Chair, although it's unheard of that the staff would have made the mistake on the what the bill does, it's not completely unheard of. We will check into it. Senate Bill 23 also comes through the Senate Revenue Committee. And as we heard the bill in the Senate at the beginning, there was actually two bills that the Senate was talking about that were incorporated within the Senate Bill 23 when it became engrossed, and that was Senate Bill 28. And the main gist of the Senate Bill 28 that was embedded into Senate Bill 23 is probably one of the four more important points of the Senate bill that clarifies a language that was previously not very obviously. And that is the issue that has to deal with a cap on bonded debt as it relates to the real market value of property within the boundaries of a county. And that has to deal with the pension liability bonds, where the 2003 session allowed those liability bonds and gave a 5% of the real market value ceiling for those indebted or indebtedness. And it was not obviously clear to all that it does not withstand with the previous 1% cap that was established for another purpose in a different section of the law. So two sections or more of the bill, of Senate Bill 23, deals with the issue of how those two ceilings work together. The rest of the bill, a lot of it you would find that it is maintaining and clarifying language for different issues. Much is also clarification of grammar and different writing styles. But the more important issues that come within the bill And it talks also about the investment, municipal and investment commission, and their the enabling languages for them and what they could do in order to clarify the different requirements for debt and bond and so on, and what they will require to use the new technology in when they're filing rather than adhering to language that is probably a little old when it comes to mailing and sending stuff around and so on. The also one of the third point that is new here is allows a council of government to go under the definition of previously what was a municipality, which is either interpreted to be a city or a county, and now the COGS or Council of Governments could also go under these rules. I think at least I went through many of these bills, but I'll just bring your attention to some of the things that went through, like in page 2 the bill where you have on line, I think that's 44, and the language in the past used to be shall mature not, and, and the new language is may not mature. I mean,
that was when that whole not thing was in
the not,
yeah.
Not thing.
Yeah, I remember that.
Not.
Well, Mazen, I'm glad that this one is so much simpler.
I don't know about simpler.
Questions of Mazen. We have two gentlemen before us. I hope they're Harvey Rogers and Pat Clancy.
We are.
Well, why don't you take it away?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Patrick Clancy. I'm chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. I'm also a partner in Western Financial Group, which is a financial advisory firm that works with state and local governments in the western United States. The Municipal Debt Advisory Commission is made up of 7 members, 2 public members, one who serves as from position, and 4 members that are representing various forms of local government. The members currently are Linda Haglin, who serves as her position the deputy treasurer. 2 public members are myself and Ed Ionowski, who's a bond counsel with Stoll Reeves, Angie Peterman, who is with the Oregon School Boards Association representing school districts, Janelle Howard, who is the finance director of Coos Bay, who represents cities, Michael Long, who is with the Association of Oregon Counties, and Bernice Bagnell, who is with Tualatin Valley Water, and she's with represents special districts. The commission is an appointed body, and it's one of its main tasks is to sort of biannually review Oregon statutes to look and see if there are things that need to be fixed, problems that have arisen, or modernization that needs to occur as the municipal market moves along and becomes different than it was in 1905, to which we hold a series of public hearings and invite representatives of the municipal finance community and of local governments to come in and talk to us about issues that they've discovered in the process of issuing municipal debt or just doing business as governments over the course of the prior years or a couple of years. We listen to those issues. We, as a commission, consider the issues, ask for some refinement. Lawyers who are local representatives of the bond community, bond counsel firms, volunteer to take the issues that the commission thinks might be meritorious away, draft language in terms of fixing the issues, and then come back for another round of hearings where we take a look at the proposed fixes and try and figure out whether they've fixed the problems or exacerbated the problems in the process.
And in that process then have, I think we went through three or four rounds of considering and winnowing bill items off of our list in terms of coming down to a core that we felt like needed to be considered. They really fall into two categories. One, which I consider fixes, which, because the debt laws in this state occur in various statutes and not in one nice spot, arise from conflicts which were, I think, unintended, as one law was passed in one place and not reflected in another place, sometimes creating a conflict or an omission. And so the majority of what we bring to you in this bill are things that the Commission believes are technical fixes. Another area that we bring items to you, and just in modernization, items such as the notification requirements, which, as we've moved to an age of electronic media instead of print, solely print media, the municipal community is using different technologies in order to implement debt financings. And so you'll see items within this bill which are really aimed at bringing Oregon statutes out of the 1905 version of the law, which really had no way of anticipating the variety and nature of debt issuance that we currently have, into this current phase. I'll say, just as an aside, and then I'm going to turn it over to Harvey Rogers, who will walk you through the various components of the bill, because Harvey acted as the main drafter for the combined legislation for us and worked with legislative counsel to come up with this bill. We have created a joint effort with the Oregon Law Commission to bring to you in the next session, not this year's session, a more major and comprehensive rewrite of the laws around municipal government, because what we have found over the years is we've basically been doing a series of band-aids, fixing individual components of the statutes. And what they really have cried out for a long time is sort of a rewriting of the entire block of statutes so that they make sense as a whole body rather than trying to make the individual pieces work with each other. And so we have a process ongoing at this point in time, which is a year or two long process that will come back in the next legislative session. We hope fixes a whole bunch of things that have sort of grown up over the years in this process. But that's not the purpose today. Today is another set of band-aids to get us through the next round, and that's what we've got. So I'd like to turn the testimony over to Harvey Rogers to walk us through that.
Mr. Rogers, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Harvey Rogers. I'm a partner in the law firm of Preston Gates and Ellis, and my group is privileged to represent the state of Oregon and governments throughout Oregon on borrowings. May I ask for a clarification from the chair? This bill is 30 pages long, and it has 34 sections. I do this stuff for a living. I think it's fascinating, and I could talk about it for hours.
Why don't we not?
And so much or not.
Why don't we stick to the version that I'll understand, not being trained in the law, but needing to know the important points, sir.
Thank you. For
and that. If Representative Boquist would like to go line by line, he could signal it at a later date, and we can arrange for it.
August 31st.
Mr. Rogers, please proceed.
Very well. If I do go too quickly on something, please
we
throw
will
something
stop
at
you,
me.
And I would ask the committee to signal me.
Thank you very much. Section 1 of the bill is a cleanup to get rid of a kind of property tax that was eliminated by Measure 50. We're proposing to get rid of that reference so that governments are not confused and think they have taxing authority that no longer exists under the law. Section 2 and a number of other sections in the bill deal with an issue that Mazin talked about. A number of years ago, the legislature passed legislation authorizing counties to borrow money and promise absolutely to pay it back from tax revenues. When the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System started to produce very substantial unfunded liabilities, some counties borrowed by issuing pension bonds under those old statutes. The legislature then came back and offered greater capacity to do pension bonds with a special pension bond statute. So Section 2 clarifies that pension bonds are subject to the new higher limits that you recently approved, that non-pension bonds are subject to the older, lower limits.
I remember that from last session.
Section 3 is an example of a technical change. It's substituting the term governmental unit for municipality. Municipality was a more limited term and inadvertently excluded some governments. So we're swapping it to the more general term.
Yes.
Thank you. Harvey, could you just quickly, we're talking cities, counties, water districts, and I didn't look up the ORS statute here. Government unit, quickly define it quickly.
Governmental unit is a general term that applies to any kind of public corporation. The term municipality referenced a statute, if I remember, there's not been any dispute about whether it's cities or counties or big deal outfits like that. It's the vector control districts and things like that of the world that tend to get left out.
Thank you.
Section 4 of the bill is a modernization provision. We used to have statutes that dictated the kind of information that governments had to give to the public finance markets when they borrowed money. The law and practice on that has evolved very dramatically over the last few years, so we've simplified the statutes and basically said that governments should provide the kind of information that is necessary to allow them to deal in the public securities markets.
Representative Bilquis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I read the statute here. We fully agree to 10 days, email, automation, so on and so forth, but I don't find on the statute, other than it says before, I mean, are we talking 1 hour before? What is common practice? We eliminated the 10-day requirement, which makes sense. Doesn't look like there's a time requirement in here at all.
There is not a timing requirement in here. What we have found is that it's like a lot of things in modern life. The amount of time it takes to do stuff is compressing. I think the policy judgment that is expressed here is that a government ought to have the freedom to make that interval as short as it thinks is prudent.
And in reality, with electronic dissemination at this point in time, sometimes when governments are, for instance, doing a refunding, notice is quite short, but they're able to achieve the levels of savings by jumping into the market. Very short notice. There's a practical reality of you can't get a transaction done if not enough people know about it. We have eliminated in this statute the timing simply because it continues to get shorter and shorter, and there are practical limitations.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Further questions?
Section 5 of the bill makes technical changes to some legislation that was adopted last session that authorizes interest rate swaps. The changes increase the regulatory power of the state treasurer in connection with interest rate swaps and ease some of the technical requirements of the bill that we have discovered weren't as brilliant as we thought they were when we all participated in the original drafting. Section 5 of the bill also clarifies that local governments cannot levy property taxes to pay something called termination payments in connection with swaps. Swaps all have a feature called a termination payment, which is an unpredictable amount that varies with market circumstances after you do the transaction. It's an amount that floats up and down. And we don't believe that the Oregon Constitution permits property taxes to be used for those purposes, and we also have a sense that that would be pretty crummy policy if property taxes could be levied for that, so this bill clarifies that that cannot be done.
On this, the changes in this ORS from last session, apparently we're not clear on this matter. Is that the technical fix we're making here, or were intended wrong? Do you understand?
Well, the technical restrictions, like one of them required that when you do a swap, the person on the other side of the swap is called a counterparty. That's a buzzword. And we had rating requirements for counterparties, and the rating requirements specified that the counterparty had to have a long-term debt rating of a particular level. And we discovered after the legislation was passed that counterparties might have ratings that were at the level that we wanted, but they weren't long-term debt ratings because of the nature of the entity and the way ratings were assigned. So it's that kind of a change.
Got it.
Okay. Section 6 is a companion to Section 2 that deals with the confusing two sets of limits on county borrowing and pension bonds. Section 7 makes changes to the definitions of that are in ORS Chapter 288 that are intended to enhance clarity. Those are changes made by Legislative Council. And it also is a conforming change to delete the reference to property tax that we no longer believe is permitted. Section 8 also deletes a reference to the property tax that has been eliminated by Measure 50, and it makes grammatical changes. It substitutes definitions that are in Section 7 of this bill for more awkward language that is in existing law. Section 9 of the bill amends the definition of bonds in ORS 288.515 to include other kinds of borrowings so that all of those borrowings access the same statutes. Section 10 of the bill amends ORS 288.605 to allow the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission or the State Treasurer to determine the kinds of securities that can be placed in advance refunding bond escrows. What happens in an advance refunding is a government borrows money and sets the money aside in an escrow to pay off the bonds it's refunding. The statutes which were adopted about 20 years ago had a reference to what everybody thought were the really nifty, swifty securities 20 years ago, and the world has changed. Some of those have ceased to be as creditworthy, and there are some new products in the market that are highly creditworthy. We thought it would be good to give the state treasurer, the debt commission, the ability to adjust the list of permitted securities as the markets change. Section 11 of the bill deals with a technical glitch when Oregon governments issue what are called advance refunding bonds. They borrow an amount of money that is just sufficient to pay off the bonds and to pay their costs. And that's a good thing. We don't want them borrowing more than they need. But the statute is so rigid that we discovered sometimes after bonds are sold, governments can reduce their costs. And then we didn't have anything to do with the money. We had this extra money, and the statute didn't allow us to spend it on anything. So we're proposing to amend the bill to allow that extra money to be spent to pay debt service on the new bond. So it stays inside the system, but it can be spent. Section 12 of the bill, like Section 4, modernizes disclosure requirements when governments are issuing bonds in the public securities markets. Section 13 clarifies that money provided by private companies in connection with what are called conduit revenue bonds. Oregon has a number of circumstances where a government can borrow money for the benefit of a private company in order to give that private company the benefit of a tax exemption that the federal government allows. So these transactions have no public money in them. This proposed change clarifies that the investment restrictions that apply to public funds don't apply to the monies of these private corporations.
Could you give an example of what you're talking about?
Sure. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department periodically issues tax-exempt bonds to finance small manufacturing facilities. It's a very heavily regulated kind of financing. The regulations come from the IRS. What the OECDD does is it facilitates that financing,
but all of the money to pay the bonds comes from the private manufacturing company. You see the same thing with low-income housing. Apartment buildings get financed like that.
Got it.
Okay.
Section 14 of the bill corrects a budget law problem. For certain kinds of borrowings, governments are required by the market to set aside money in a reserve that is used only to pay the bonds and only if the expected money isn't available. These are typically like sewer and water revenue bonds where the government's only obligated to pay it from water revenues. The market requires the government to set aside some money to pay the bonds in case they have a ratepayer strike or something like that. And we discovered to our amusement and horror that the budget law doesn't allow them to spend that money on those bonds when they need to. So we're fixing that and saying that that money in those dedicated reserves can be spent without filing a supplemental budget. Section 15 of the bill amends a statute to provide that hospital facilities authorities, which are a special kind of quasi-governmental unit that issues conduit bonds for nonprofit hospitals. So again, it's no public money is involved. That those entities do not are not required to have audits. Sections 16 and 17 provide that a board or commission established under a city charter must be audited separately and not as a single entity. This is a clarity of disclosure provision. Section 18 corrects a drafting omission. Last session, I believe it was last session or two sessions ago, Oregon has a set of laws that originally came about way back when Measure 5 passed that are intended to allow citizens and governments to get a speedy judicial resolution of nasty questions that arise under the Constitution and the borrowing laws. And the way that system works is that a matter that arises is taken to the Oregon Tax Court, and there's a direct appeal from the tax court to the Oregon Supreme Court. There's a set of notices that the public entity can give to ask people to sue it if they're upset about something, and then private citizens can also initiate action. When we ask, and the legislature amended this legislation last time to allow it to deal with some questions about the use of general obligation bond proceeds. The use of general obligation bond proceeds is regulated by Measure 5 and Measure 50, Article 11, Section 11 and 11B of the Oregon Constitution. We put in a section to allow those questions to be resolved in the same way, and a piece of it got left out. And so this is adding back the piece that should have been in there that relates to a filing deadline. Sections 19 through 24 conform a bunch of related statutes to some changes that were made by Section 13. Sections 25 through 27, I've got an error in my notes. Section 25, 26, and 27 delete references to a statute that is being repealed by Section 31 of the bill. Section 28 of the bill amends a statute to make a conforming change to what Section 7 of this bill does. It also makes minor grammatical changes. Section 29 amends a statute to conform it to the changes made by Section 7. Section 30 conforms the statute to the changes made by Section 13. Section 31 deals with some property tax difficulties. It turns out that when Measure 50 passed, there was a relatively comprehensive amendment of the property tax statutes, and one of the things that seems to have happened inadvertently is the statute that authorized governments to levy property taxes to pay outstanding general obligation bonds got changed from saying that to say that the governments could levy taxes to pay the bonds during the next fiscal year. That created a cash flow problem because the fiscal year starts in July, but the property taxes don't come in until late November. So what governments need to do is they need to be able to collect taxes in November and use them until the next November, which is actually two fiscal years. But the statute had been changed to say they could only use it for one fiscal year. So Section 31 changes, fixes that. And then it also addresses a problem that arose in the courts. Every once in a while, a general obligation bond is a bond, a local government general obligation bond is a bond that's payable from a separate property tax. It's also an obligation of the government that's unconditional. So if the property tax money isn't sufficient, the government has to pay the bond anyway. A court had interpreted the language of 294.381 to prevent the government from using its own money and then reimbursing itself from the property tax levy. And that's a particular problem when you think about cash flows. If a government isn't getting its taxes until November and it has a payment that it needs to make in October, it ought to be able to make the payment and get the property tax money back. So we're fixing that in Section 31. Section 32 is a conforming change for Section 5 of the bill. Section 33 is a companion to Section 2 of the bill and just, again, it's another pension bond issue, and it clarifies that governments that issued bonds before the new pension bill was passed get the benefit of the new pension limit. The earlier sections made sure that the two limits did not cross over. Section 34 of the bill, this is the last section of the bill, repeals ORS 288.310 and ORS 288.320. Those statutes have been part of the law for who knows how long. They were certainly around when I was practicing law, and periodically they've been amended. And I'm supposed to be a specialist in this, and I learned from a guy who'd been doing it for years before me, and he never understood what those sections did. They have finally gotten to the point where we can't find anybody who understands what they do, and they appear to prohibit some fairly normal transactions. So we're asking that they be repealed. And that's all the comments I have. I'd be happy to try and answer questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Clancy?
It's Mr. Rogers.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rogers.
I have some questions.
Please, Representative Burner.
First question is rhetorical. This is the Band-Aid?
There are a lot of small cuts.
Apparently we have major bleeding somewhere. I mean, I'm a little disturbed that there's more of this out here in this statutory language, particularly this last one. Oh, nobody knows what it means, and so let's get rid of it. That's not exactly a message that's happy. But there's some specific things. The difference between a municipal corporation and a governmental unit?
Both of those terms in the context of ORS Chapter 288 and the basic statutory structure is Chapter 286 of the statutes deals with state borrowing, Chapter 287 of the statutes deals with local government borrowing, and Chapter 288 deals with government borrowing generally.
Okay.
And one of the things that we're hopeful that the Law Commission is going to do is sort of untangle stuff, because what's happened over the years is bills get dropped into different things. Both of those terms are defined somewhere in the statute. And it turns out that governmental unit was the more recently created, more inclusive definition. Municipality was an earlier definition that was less inclusive.
But we now have municipal corporation. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, please.
We have a third construct called municipal corporation. And
I'm sorry,
somewhere in here I saw one of these sections. I said, oh, now we're talking about municipal corporations.
Was that in the hospital section?
I found it somewhere as we were going.
Facilities authority in section.
There it is, page 19, section 15.
And it's hospital facilities authority.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, That's one of the things that we'd love to fix at the Law Commission thing. What we have tried to do here is not fix anything more than we could look you in the eye and say this needs to be done, and even so, we ended up with 30 pages of conforming amendments.
I just wanted to bring that sort of... Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Rogers? Thank you very much. Let's see. Mr. Clancy, did you have an opportunity to present already then?
I did.
Excellent. I apologize for being late back in the committee. There's no one else signed up on behalf of Senate Bill 23 as they amended. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 23A. The next item on our agenda is Senate Bill 24. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 24. Steve? Thank you.
Thanks, Madam.
He's here.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 24 is at least as easy as the prior three bills. It deals with the Common School Fund, and more specifically, the distributable income account within the Common School Fund. It basically, in current law, there's several references to different kinds of income, whether it's interest income, profits income, dividend income, and the bill deletes references to specific kinds of income and just uses income to apply to all of them. So it doesn't have to, any income doesn't have to fit into one of the categories that's in current statutes. The other provision is that it deletes the language that requires that losses on investments be deducted from the distributable income account. And that takes effect beginning in 05.
That's been an issue in the past on the Common School Fund, because if you're carrying securities with loss, then you get to stop and make that adjustment. Is that right, Steve?
Yes, and taking those losses could reduce the amount available for distribution below the 2% or what the
right.
board would want to distribute.
Without having actually a trigger event other than just market values.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Other issues there that have been discussed on the Senate side with regard to this bill?
Let's see. So the primary goal, I think, was to try to make a distinction or uncouple any connection between investment policy and distribution policy.
Okay. All right. Mike Mueller? I think I have your card, but I'm going to get a copy, another copy of it here from somewhere at some point. Yeah, there it is. Okay, thank you. Please proceed, Mike. Aaron, sign on.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments for the Oregon State Treasury. As you've heard, Senate Bill 24 removes the requirement that losses resulting from the sale of investments be deducted from the distributable income account and credited to the Common School Fund, and it revises and clarifies language relating to the crediting of income from investments to the distributable income account. I'll just make some very brief points. Modern portfolio theory subscribes to managing investment assets based on what's called a total return basis. That is, giving consideration not just to the income an investment generates, but its appreciation or depreciation as well. Managing a portfolio for income and or to minimize losses is not in the long-term best interest of the fund beneficiaries, in this case K through 12 education. The current statute as written is too prescriptive in its language and provides for investment terms that are not clearly defined and may be subject to interpretation. The proposed legislation will align the law with the best practices of money management from a prudent investor standpoint. Lastly, the distribution of funds from the Common School Fund should not hinge on the year-to-year investment activity of the fund, i.e. the income gains and losses, but rather based on the long-term performance of the fund, much like you'd see in an endowment fund. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. My questions for Mr. Mueller. Mike, can you... I always do much better with some kind of a graph, and I know that I've seen some information from the Treasurer's Office that actually show, I'm not sure who it was that brought me the information that clarifies this information relative to what is income for the purposes of the subsequent sale of equity investments and those kinds of things for the pooling. And I'm trying to remember who. Yeah, I think it may have been Kate that I talked to that I said, why don't we develop some sort of a matrix that would show if I have gain on securities, loss on securities, and then if I sell them early or sell them late, how much that makes for the DIA and the Common School Fund, what difference that makes. And I prepared myself a matrix for the highs and lows, what this bill has the effect of doing to basically come up to true up the amount of the real earnings to the various funds, the Common School Fund and the daily income or the distributable income account. Do you have anything like that in your file?
Chair Butler, I do not.
Okay. Colleagues, I'm kind of a visual person in that regard, and I had to do that for my own purposes, and I think that would be helpful to have each of us see what that looks like when there are gains in the fund and losses in the fund, and you sell early or sell late under any of those circumstances, what that does to the and how this calculation basically trues up the gains or losses on securities.
Yeah, Chair Butler, I would just say that all of those items kind of flow into and out of the account, and the idea here is to manage the fund in perpetuity and look at what the fund can generate over the very long term and set the distribution policy in accordance with that, and quite honestly not concern ourselves with the annual fluctuations that may take place in the portfolio relative to gains or losses, but again with a view to the long term, with the recognition that we have distributions to make on an annual basis.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Mueller relative to Senate Bill 24? Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Representative Comp?
Chairman Butler, were you going to get us a graph or chart?
I'll work with the office to get a graph. I would like to do that.
That'd be great.
So that you can each kind of see what I had to visualize. And I made my own graph to show where there were gains on certain security, losses on other securities, and whether they were sold early or sold late in the transaction there, and the process is that this bill does assist us whether there are gain or losses. Actually, the value at the end of the cycle, and they really true up the amount of real time earnings to the account. So. And I'm interested for all of us to have a pretty good feel as to how that works. I don't think I want to leave session with us having any kind of question as to how this will work, so that we can explain it to our grandkids at some later point.
Thank you,
Representative Escobar.
Besides that, Mr. Chair, I know the Revenue Office would love to do a graph.
Oh yeah,
they really like those graphs.
Of course, it's not revenue that we would ask them to do. Let's have Treasury. Let's have Treasury come up with.
Yeah.
We want revenue to do it.
They enjoy it.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on September 24. Colleagues, we have scheduled on our schedule the possible reconsideration of 3466, a reconsideration takes 2/3 vote of the, and this is the. Sports action bill that we'd had previously. I did not sign off the sports action to move to the floor because we have everything in the file. I just didn't know whether or not We'd reviewed everything in the file for the satisfaction of all members. I've had discussions with some of the members. I'm told by Legislative Revenue Office that the file is accurate, that everything is in the file, so nothing more needs to be added to the file. And unless it's the desire of the members of the committee to reconsider it at this time, I'm still of the opinion that it passed out of here with the correct information in the file. Based upon that, is there any discussion to reconsider it, to bring it before a reconsideration? We're not adding anything to the file. We're not subtracting anything from the file. I was just anxious. So if there's nothing further, I'm going to just bypass the 2234, and we will not reconsider it and move it to the floor as previously passed out of the committee.
3466.
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. 3466. Off one day. With that, we will then open a public hearing on Senate Bill 25. And let's see, Senate Bill 25 is Liz Beth.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with Senate Bill 25A, this comes to you again from the Treasury Department, but it is dealing with the Oregon's College Savings Network. Now, I know this session we haven't really talked about this program yet, but this is administered by the Treasury Department. It's making some changes, and basically what it's doing is it's just allowing the Treasury Department the ability to accept donations for awarding scholarships, grants, and other incentives to account owners and their beneficiaries. It allows the Treasury Department's ability to encourage participation by awarding these grants and scholarships and providing other incentives to account owners and their beneficiaries or entering into promotional arrangements. It amends ORS 348-856 by specifying that all monies credited to the Oregon 529 College Savings Network Fund are continuously appropriated to the Oregon College Savings Board. And it also specifies the sources of the Oregon College Savings Network Fund to include then these gifts and donations that you would be allowing them in this bill to make, and they would go into the same fund. It clarifies that the board can use the money in the fund to pay the administrative costs and expenses of the board and the College Savings Network to provide those scholarships or grants to the account owners and potential account owners and their beneficiaries. It excludes the Oregon College Savings Network and board from public contracting law. It applies to public contracts entered into on or after the effective date of the 2005 Act, and it does attach an emergency clause to this Act, so it begins March 1st, 2005. Now, again, with the Oregon College Savings Network, this has been enacted in 1999. It piggybacks off the federal 529 College Savings Networks, and it's designed to pay for education-related expenses. Under current law, contributions by Oregon taxpayers to Oregon College Savings accounts can be deducted on your personal income taxes up to $2,000 for joint returns and $1,000 for other tax returns. So basically, we have about 23,000 accounts of these Oregon Savings Network accounts. And what this would be doing is obviously encouraging more people to participate in the College Savings Network. So there is, could potentially be additional reductions in revenue to the state because you would have larger Oregon tax subtractions. But it should be minimal each year, less than $50,000. So you do have a revenue impact statement, but it is minimal.
Questions for staff? Thank you, Elizabeth. Let's see, we have Michael Parker from Treasury here. Please, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I want to give you a quick update on the network, what it is, and the progress the network has achieved over the past 4 years since it was implemented. The network is administered by the State Treasury and is comprised of three separate college savings plans. Each plan of the network is a unique investment vehicle that provides significant tax advantages and flexibility to help families save for college. Oregonians who participate in the network can take a tax deduction each year from their state taxes, and earnings and withdrawals are both state and federally tax-free if used for qualified expenses. Families may use their savings at eligible institutions of higher education, public or private, all over the United States, and for a wide range of expenses, including tuition, books, fees, and room and board expenses. It basically covers every cost of college. The network has enjoyed remarkable success in its first 4 years. By the end of the first year, in 2001, families had opened about 10,000 accounts and invested about $33 million. We've seen significant growth in the network, helping families save. Today, the network has more than 60,000 accounts over its three plans and nearly $450 million in assets, demonstrating a true need for this type of investment vehicle going forward. I wanted to point out one thing quickly regarding the budget. The network is fully self-supporting. We take no general fund money from the state. In fact, due to some insightful management decisions by the College Savings Board, we have significantly lowered the fees we charge to participants while still maintaining our self-supporting status. The network has been so well received by Oregonians that the Treasury will return the balance of its general fund loan, which it borrowed in the 99 and 01 sessions, before the end of the current biennium. I want to just address quickly Senate Bill 25 very quickly. Basically, Senate Bill 25 makes two improvements to the College Savings Network. As staff had mentioned, it allows the network the authority to create scholarships, grants, and other incentives with the goal of increasing awareness and participation in the state's college savings program. Sure. The state's College Savings Board is concerned about higher access to college and a college education. With the ability to create scholarships and incentives to save, the board can further the public policy goal of providing access to affordable higher education. And the second thing that Senate Bill 25 does is it aligns the College Savings Network with the rest of Treasury and the College Savings Board allowing the network to be in line with the public contracting code under state law. So it just aligns the board with the statutes that Treasury currently has. Since we are operated inside of Treasury, we're aligned with the public contracting code of Treasury. So that's what the cleanup language does for that. Those are the only two major changes to Senate Bill 25. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
The resources for the authority or for the funding of scholarships, grants, and other incentives to make aware of the college savings programs?
Mr. Chair, the resources that we would use for any sort of scholarship or incentive come from our private sector program managers. We have negotiated payments from those folks to help us market and help us do education awareness in the state. The money that we get from those private sector partners would go for the scholarships.
So at that point, we'll have the Treasury office running a scholarship program.
Mr. Chair, we contemplate potentially working with other state agencies like the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and those groups to potentially do a scholarship program. We're contemplated by this bill to do that eventually, but this bill also gives the ability to do some one-off stuff. So if we want to partner with, let's say, the Credit Union Association to do a scholarship, you know, basically, to make it crude, just a scholarship program with the Credit Union Association, this gives the ability to grant those dollars to that association in partnership. So it's kind of a two-pronged thing. We like to do some one-off incentives, but also a long-term scholarship program as well.
It's anticipated that the funds to do this will be generated from the excess earnings, as well as grants or contributions made by your partners in the 529 College Savings Network. Have you vetted this with Ways and Means at this particular point, Michael?
Mr. Chair, this bill has not gone through Ways and Means.
The idea? Your budget? What of the Treasury?
Oh, Treasury's budget, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, Treasury's budget has gone through Ways and Means, correct. Okay. There is no impact to staff. We're not going to add any staff to make this happen. What we're planning on doing, Mr. Chair, is partnering with the private sector, like I said, credit unions or banks, to help us with this process.
There no additional appropriation allowance, though. There'd have to be an appropriation allowance if we're going to be expending the funds through the Treasury.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We do have an expenditure allowance in our budget to make this happen. We're keeping it within our professional services expenditure allowance.
That's correct. Was it specifically identified for the Ways and Means as some sort of a scholarship, grants, other incentives?
Mr. Chair, it's not specifically contemplated. It's within professional services that we would earmark for marketing purposes. So it's not specifically outlined for scholarships. It would be within our marketing budget.
So that puts the Treasury's office, Treasury, then through the 529 plans, working in conjunction with your network partners to come up with a new scholarship program and an incentives program specifically designed around the encouragement or incentives to recognize awareness of the 529 programs and opportunities to go on for higher education. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We really want to get more folks involved in the 529 program, want them to be aware of it and then involved in it. So this is a way that we can raise awareness, education about what it takes to save for college, contemplating that we are going to try to get this thing all across the state in every single county.
And in that process, Michael, when you went through the Ways and Means process to appropriate that within your and I assume it's embedded in your current budget, what's the amount that you're anticipating?
Mr. Chair, we don't have an identified amount. I will tell you that the board expends roughly $500,000 to $600,000 a year to do education awareness within the state. So we would carve off a piece of that marketing budget to go for any sort of scholarship program that we manage to put together.
So the total could be between $1 million and $1.2 million on a biennium. And some portion of that could then be dedicated for the awareness scholarships.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We would anticipate, and I hate to give you a number, but it likely maybe 10% of that would go towards these. And again, our marketing budget, every biennium will likely increase as assets increase in the program. So we really want to, at least the treasurer has indicated that he really wants to set a scholarship program in place in perpetuity. So that's what this bill allows us to do.
Who specifically are your partners right now? You used to be with the Strong Funds, and then they got bumped on the nose, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. When the Oregon College Savings Plan was first enacted in 99, our College Savings Board hired Strong Capital Management in 2000 and 2001 to run the program. Unfortunately, in late 2003, Strong had some problems with market timing issues and other ethical problems. Strong was a privately held company by one person, and the board took very swift action to eliminate Strong from the program. Within a couple of months, they were gone. And the board hired Oppenheimer Funds and Vanguard to manage the direct product. We also have a firm called MFS Investment Management that runs an advisor-sold product for us as well. So Oppenheimer, Vanguard, and MFS are the three private sector partners we currently have.
And Oppenheimer, Vanguard, MFS are all parties to what you're attempting to do.
Correct.
Will this advance the funds themselves or their participation in it?
Mr. Chair, this would the advantage to the private sector partners is they'll have more money under management as we get more awareness and participation. The state itself or the board doesn't market these firms. We market the concept of college savings.
I appreciate it, but I guess if we're going to go to them and ask them to participate, do I do this? And this has nothing to do with the treasurer. It has everything to do with advancing private industry within the state. Does Oppenheimer, Vanguard, or MFS get any of the credit for what we're doing? Is it who's going to be in the headlights and the banner here? Is it going to be the private industry that's funding this, or is it going to be the Treasurer's office?
Mr. Chair, we anticipate that the Treasurer and the State of Oregon will be front and center marketing this program.
Okay.
What we do with the private sector firms is, because Oppenheimer and Vanguard have very good names in the marketplace, we use those to our advantage, but they're never front and center.
Okay. Representative Hass, please.
Thank you. I'm a member of 529, the savings plan, and I'm very happy with the way it works, with the exception of that bump in the nose. I do have some questions. I'm not clear on who would be donating money and what kinds of where that comes from, is your soliciting.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Pass, where the money comes from basically is we have contracts with Oppenheimer and Vanguard. And through those contracts, they're obligated to provide us resources every year to market the program. So that money comes into our account, and we get appropriated legislative appropriation to spend that money. The program also takes 10 basis points from participants to run the program, pays for salaries and legal fees and auditing fees. So the total sources of revenue comes from the private sector partners just writing us a check every year to help us market the program and the 10 basis points that comes in from the participants. So that's where all of our revenue comes from. Now, in addition, we are planning on talking to the private sector to get additional donations as if we end up with a permanent scholarship program. We really want to solicit money from the private sector to actually put money in this as well. So that hasn't happened yet, but we're contemplating soliciting those resources as well.
Is that responsive, Representative?
Yes, follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
So can you give me an idea about how much that is, and do you need to have rules in place, such as the Oregon Student Assistance Commission has tons of rules, administrative rules and laws that lay out how scholarships are given to make sure that family members or people or, you know, one special group doesn't get preferential treatment? You know, how will that sort of apparatus work?
Mr. Chair, President Pass, yes. In fact, it's contemplated that we're going to go back to our board. We're anticipating if Senate Bill 25 would pass, we're actually going to go back to the board with some rule changes with our administrative rules. So definitely we're going to work this out so it's done by administrative rule, also then working with the other state agencies that will follow their rules as well. Question about how much money we bring in every year. Both Oppenheimer and MFS provide the board approximately $350,000 per year to help market the program. So each would provide $700,000 a biennium to help market the program. Market the program and pay for legal fees, auditing fees, and everything else it takes to run the program. Marketing being our very biggest expense, and education and awareness.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Michael. Appreciate your presentation here today.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 25. Other items for the good of the order today. I don't have anything further on my, unless I move over to Tuesday like I just did, or Wednesday like I just did. So just trying to get ready which day of the week we're on. If there's no further business for today, we'll go ahead and close revenue today. Thank you.